This is Rachel, recording for Radio Talking Book Network in Omaha, Nebraska. I will be reading Bookshelf, starting with Part 13 of Dracula by Bram Stoker. I could not see but how right he was, and the terrible despair of Mina's face became relaxed a thought. There was hope in such good counsel. Van Helsing went on. When once within that house, we may find more clues. At any rate, some of us can remain there, whilst the rest find the other places where there be more earth boxes, at Bermondsey and Mile End. Lord Godalming stood up. I can be of some use here, he said. I shall wire to my people to have horses and carriages where they will be most convenient.
Look here, old fellow, said Morris. It is a capital idea to have all ready in case we want to go horsebacking. But don't you think that one of your snappy carriages with its heraldic adornments in a byway of Walworth or Mile End would attract too much attention for our purposes? It seems to me we ought to take some cabs when we go south or east, and even then leave them somewhere near the neighborhood we are going to.
Friend Quincy is right, said the professor. His head is what you call in plane with the horizon. It is a difficult thing that we may do, and we do not want no peoples to watch us, if so it may. Mina took a growing interest in everything, and I was rejoiced to see that the exigency of affairs was helping her to forget for a time the terrible experience of the night. She was very, very pale, almost ghastly, and so thin her lips were drawn away, showing her teeth in somewhat of prominence. I did not mention this last, lest it should give her needless pain, but it made my blood run cold in my veins to think of what occurred with poor Lucy when the Count had sucked her blood. As yet there was no sign of the teeth growing sharper, but time as yet was short, and there was time to fear. When we came to the discussion of the sequence of our efforts and the disposition of our forces, there were new sources of doubt. It was finally agreed that before starting for Piccadilly, we should destroy the Count's lair close at hand. In case he should find it out too soon, we should thus be still ahead of him in our work of destruction, and his presence in his purely material shape and at his weakest might give us some new clue. As to the disposal of forces, it was suggested by the professor that after our visit to Carfax, we should all enter the house in Piccadilly, and that the two doctors and I should remain there, whilst Lord Godalming and Quincy found the lairs at Walworth and Mile End and destroyed them. If possible, if not likely, the professor urged that the Count might appear in Piccadilly during the day, and that if so, we might be able to cope with him then and there. At any rate, we might be able to follow him in force. To this plan I strenuously objected, insofar as my going was concerned, for I said I intended to stay and protect Mina. I thought that my mind was made up on that subject, but Mina would not listen to my objection. She said there might be some law matter in which I could be useful, that amongst the Count's papers might be some clue which I could understand out of my experience in Transylvania, and that, as it was, all the strength we could master was required to cope with the Count's extraordinary power. I had to give in, for Mina's resolution was fixed. She said that it was the last hope for her that we should all work together. As for me, she said, I have no fear. Things have been as bad as they can be, and whatever may happen must have in it some element of hope or comfort. Go, my husband. God can, if he wishes it, guard me as well alone as with anyone present. So I started crying out. Then in God's name let us come at once, for we are losing time. The Count may come to Piccadilly earlier than we think. Not so, said Van Helsing, holding up his hand. But why? I asked. Do you forget, he said, with actually a smile, that last night he banqueted heavily and will sleep late? Did I forget? Shall I ever? Can I ever? Can any of us ever forget that terrible scene? Mina struggled hard to keep her brave countenance, but the pain overmastered her, and she put her hands before her face and shuddered whilst she moaned. Van Helsing had not intended to recall her frightful experience. He had simply lost sight of her, and her part in the affair of his intellectual effort. When it struck him what he'd said, he was horrified at his thoughtlessness, and tried to comfort her. "Oh, Madam Mina," he said, "dear, dear Madam Mina, alas, it is I of all who so reverence you should have said anything so forgetful. These stupid old lips of mine and this stupid old head do not deserve so, but will you forget it? Will you not?" He bent low beside her as he spoke. She took his hand, and looking at him through her tears, said, "No, I shall not forget, for it is well that I remember, and with it I have so much in memory of you that is sweet that I take it all together. Now, you must be going soon. Breakfast is ready, and that we must all eat, so that we may be strong." Breakfast was a strange meal to us all. We tried to be cheerful and encourage each other, and Mina was the brightest and most cheerful of us all. When it was over, Van Helsing stood up and said, "Now, my dear friends, we go forth to our terrible enterprise. Are we all armed, as we were on the night when we first visited our enemy's lair, armed against ghostly as well as carnal attack?" We all assured him. "Then all is well. Now, Madam Mina, you are in any case quite safe here until the sunset, and before then, if we shall return, but before we go, let me see you armed against personal attack. I have myself, since you came down, prepared your chamber by the placing of the things of which we know, so that he may not enter. Now, let me guard yourself. On your forehead, I touch this piece of sacred wafer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and—" There was a fearful scream, which almost froze our hearts to hear. As he placed the wafer on Mina's forehead, it had seared it. It had burned into the flesh, as though it were a piece of white-hot metal. My poor darling's brain told her the significance of the fact as quickly as her nerves received the pain of it, and the two so overwhelmed her that her overwrought nature had found its voice in that dreadful scream. But the words to her thought came quickly. The echo of the scream had not ceased to ring on the air when there came the reaction, and she sank to her knees on the floor in an agony of abasement. Pulling her beautiful hair over her face, as the leper of old his mantle, she wailed out, "Unclean! Unclean! Even the Almighty shuns my polluted flesh! I must bear this mark of shame upon my forehead until the judgment day!" They all paused. I had thrown myself beside her in an agony of helpless grief, and putting my arms around her, held her tight. For a few minutes our sorrowful hearts beat together, whilst the friends around us turned their eyes that ran tears silently. Then Van Helsing turned and said gravely, so gravely that I could not help feeling that he was in some way inspired and was stating things outside himself, "It may be that you may have to bear that mark till God himself see fit, as he most surely shall on the judgment day to redress all wrongs of the earth and all of his children that he has placed thereon. And oh, Madam Mina, my dear, may we who love you be there to see when that red scar, the sign of God's knowledge of what has been, shall pass away and leave your forehead as pure as the heart we know. For so surely as we live, that scar shall pass away when God sees right to lift the burden that is hard upon us. Till then, we bear our cross as his Son did in obedience to his will. It may be that we are chosen instruments of his good pleasure, and that we ascend to his bidding, as that other through stripes and shame, through tears and blood, through doubts and fears, and all that makes the difference between God and man." There was hope in his words, and comfort, and they were made for resignation. Mina and I both felt so, and simultaneously we each took one of the old man's hands and bent over and kissed it. And then, without a word, we all knelt down together, and all holding hands swore to be true to each other. We men pledged ourselves to raise the veil of sorrow from the head of her whom, in his own way, we loved, and we prayed for help and guidance in the terrible task which lay before us. It was then time to start. So I so said farewell to Mina, a parting which neither of us shall forget to our dying day. and we set out. To one thing, I've made up my mind. If we find out that Mina must be a vampire in the end, then she shall not go into that unknown and terrible land alone. I suppose it is thus that in old times one vampire meant many. Just as their hideous bodies could only rest in sacred earth, so the holiest love was the recruiting sergeant for their ghastly ranks. We entered Carfax without trouble, and found all things the same as on the first occasion. It was hard to believe that among so prosaic surroundings of neglect and dust and decay, there was any ground for such fear as we already knew. Had our minds not been made up, and had there not been terrible memories to spur us on, we could have hardly proceeded with our task. We found no papers, or any sign of use in the house, and the old chapel, the great boxes, looked just as we had seen them last. Dr. Van Helsing said to us solemnly as we stood before them, "And now, my friends, we have a duty here to do. We must sterilize this earth, so sacred of holy memories, that he has brought from far a distant land for such fell use. He has chosen this earth because it has been holy. Thus we defeat him with his own weapon, for we make it more holy still. It was sanctified to such use of man, now we sanctify it to God." As he spoke, he took from his bag a screwdriver and a wrench, and very soon one of the top of the cases was thrown open. The earth smelled musty and close, but we did somehow not seem to mind, for our attention was concentrated on the professor. Taking from his box a piece of the sacred wafer, he laid it down reverently in the earth, and then, shutting the lid down, began to screw it home, we aiding him as he worked. One by one, we treated in the same way each of the great boxes, and left them as we had found them to all appearance, but in each was a portion of the host. When we closed the door behind us, the professor said solemnly, "So much is already done. If it may be that with all the others we can be so successful, then the sunset of this evening may shine on Madame Mina's forehead, all white as ivory, and with no stain." As we passed across the lawn on our way to the station to catch our train, we could see the front of the asylum. I looked eagerly, and in the window of my own room I saw Mina. I waved my hand to her and nodded to tell her that our work there was successfully accomplished. She nodded in reply to show she understood. The last I saw, she was waving her hand in farewell. It was with a heavy heart that we sought the station and just caught the train, which was steaming in as we reached the platform. I've written this on the train. Piccadilly, 12:30 o'clock. Just before we reached Fenchurch Street, Lord Godalming said to me, "Quincy and I will find a locksmith. You better not come with us in case there should be any difficulty, for under the circumstances it wouldn't seem so bad for us to break into an empty house. But you are a solicitor, and the Incorporated Law Society might tell you you should have known better." I demurred, as to my not sharing any danger even of odium, but he went on. "Besides, it'll attract less attention if there's not too many of us. My title will make it all right with the locksmith, and with any policeman that might come along. You'd better go with Jack and the professor and stay in the Green Park, somewhere inside of the house. And when you come see the door open and the smith gone away, do you all come across. She'll be on the lookout for you and she'll let you in." "The advice is good," said Van Helsing. So we said no more. Godalming and Morris hurried off in a cab, we following in another. At the corner of Arlington Street, our contingent got out and strolled onto the Green Park. My heart beat as I saw the house on which so much of our hope was centered, looming up grim and silent in its deserted condition amongst its more lively and spruce-looking neighbors. We sat down on a bench within good view and began to smoke cigars so as to attract as little attention as possible. The minutes seemed to pass with leaden feet as we waited for the coming of the others. At length, we saw a four-wheeler drive up. Out of it, in leisurely fashion, got Lord Godalming and Morris, and down from the box descended a thick-set working man and his rush-woven basket of tools. Morris paid the cabman, who touched his hat, and drove away. Together, the two ascended the steps, and Lord Godalming pointed out what he wanted done. The workman took off his coat, leisurely, and hung it on the spikes of the rail, saying something to a policeman, who then just sauntered along. The policeman nodded acquiescence, and the man kneeling down placed his bag beside him. After searching through it, he took out a selection of tools, which he proceeded to lay beside him in an orderly fashion. He then stood up, looked into the keyhole, blew into it, and, turning to his employers, made some remark. Lord Godalming smiled, and the man lifted a good-sized bunch of keys. Selecting one of them, he began to probe the lock as if feeling his way with it. After fumbling about for a bit, he tried a second, and then a third. All at once, the door opened under a slight push from him, and he and the two others entered the hall. We sat still. My own cigar burnt furiously, but Van Helsing's went cold altogether. We waited patiently as we saw the workman come out and bring in his bag. Then he held the door partly open, steadying it with his knees, while he fitted a key to the lock. This he finally handed to Lord Godalming, who took out his purse and gave him something. The man touched his hat, took his bag, put on his coat, and departed. Not a soul took the slightest notice of the whole transaction. When the man had fairly gone, we three crossed the street and knocked at the door. It was immediately opened by Quincy Morris, beside whom stood Lord Godalming, lighting a cigar. "The place smells so vilely," said the latter, as we came in. It did indeed smell vilely, like the old chapel at Carfax, and with our previous experience, it was plain to us that the Count had been using the place pretty freely. We moved to explore the house, all keeping together in case of attack, for we knew we had a strong and wily enemy to deal with, and as yet we did not know whether the Count might not be in the house. In the dining room, which lay at the back of the hall, we found 8 boxes of earth. 8 boxes only, out of the 9 which were sought. Our work was not over, would never be over until we should find the missing box. First, we opened the shutters of the window, which looked out across a narrow stone-flagged yard at the blank face of a stable, pointed to look like the front of a miniature house. There were no windows in it, so we were not afraid of being overlooked. We did not lose any time in examining the chests. With the tools which we had brought us, we opened them one by one, and treated them as we treated those in the old chapel. It was evident to us that the Count was not present in the house, and we proceeded to search for any of his effects. After a cursory glance at the rest of the rooms, from basement to attic, we came to the conclusion that the dining room contained any effects which might belong to the Count, and so we proceeded to minutely examine them. They lay in a sort of orderly disorder on the great dining room table. There were title deeds of the Piccadilly House in a great bundle, deeds of the purchase at the houses of Mile End and Bermondsey, notepaper, envelope, pens, and ink. All were covered up in thin wrapping paper to keep them from the dust. There was also a clothes brush, a brush and comb, a jug and basin, the latter containing dirty water which was reddened as if with blood. Last of all was a little heap of keys of all sorts and sizes, probably those belonging to the other houses. When we had examined this last find, Lord Godalming and Quincy Morris, taking accurate notes of the various addresses of the houses in the east and the south, took with them the keys in a great bunch and set out to destroy the boxes in these places. The rest of us are, with what patience we can, waiting their return, or the coming of the Count. Dr. Seward's Diary, 3rd of October. The time seemed terribly long whilst we were waiting for the coming of Godalming and Quincy Morris. The professor tried to keep our mind active by using them all the time. I could see his beneficent purpose by the side glances which he threw from time to time at Harker. The poor fellow was overwhelmed with a misery that's appalling to see. Last night he was a frank, happy-looking man, with a strong, youthful face, full of energy, and with dark brown hair. Today he is a drawn, haggard old man, whose white hair matches well with the hollow, burning eyes and grief-written lines of his face. His energy is still intact. In fact, he's like a living flame. This may yet be his salvation, for if all goes well, it will tide him over the despairing period. He will then, in a kind of way, wake up again to the realities of life. Poor fellow, I thought my own trouble was bad enough, but his... The professor knows this well enough, and is doing his best to keep his mind active. What he's been saying was, under the circumstances, of absorbing interest. So well as I can remember, here it is. I have studied, over and over again since they came into my hands, all the papers relating to this monster. And the more I have studied, the more greater seems the necessity to utterly stamp him out. All there are signs of his advance, not only of his power, but of his knowledge of it. As I learned from the researches of my friend Arminius of Budapest, he was in life a most wonderful man, soldier, statesman, alchemist, which latter was the highest development of the science knowledge of his time. He had a mighty brain, a learning beyond compare, and a heart that knew no fear and no remorse. He dared even to attend the Scholomance, and there was no branch of knowledge in his time that he did not essay. Well, in him, the brain powers survived the physical death, though it would seem that memory was not all complete. In some faculties of mind, he has been, and is, only a child. But he is growing, and some things that were childish at the first are now of man's stature. He is experimenting and doing it well, and if it had not been that we crossed his path, he would be yet, he may be yet if we fail, the father or furtherer of a new order of beings whose road must lead through death, not life. Harker groaned and said, "And this is all arrayed against my darling. But how is he experimenting? The knowledge may yet help us defeat him." "He has all along, since his coming, been trying his power. Slowly but surely, that big child brain of his is working. Well, for us, it is, as yet, a child brain. For had he dared at the first to attempt certain things, he would long ago have been beyond our power. However, he means to succeed, and a man who has centuries before him can afford to wait and go slow. Festina lente may well be his motto." "I fail to understand," said Harker wearily. "Oh, do be more plain to me. Perhaps grief and trouble are dulling my brain." The professor laid his hand tenderly on his shoulder as he spoke. "Ah, my child, I would be plain. Do you not see how, of late, this monster has been creeping into knowledge experimentally? How he has been making use of the zoophagus patient to effect his entry into friend John's home? For your vampire, though in all afterwards he can come when and how he will, must at the first make entry only when asked thereto by an inmate. But these are not his most important experiments. Do we not see how, at first, all these so great boxes were moved by others? He knew not then, but that must be so. But all the time that so great child of his brain was working, and he began to consider whether or not he himself might move the box, so he began to help, and then, when he found that this be all right, he tried to move them alone. And so he progressed, and he scatter these graves of him, and none but he know where they are hidden. He may have intend to bury them deep in the ground, so that only he use them in the night, or at such time as he can change his form. They do him equal well, and none may know that these are his hiding place. But, my child, do not despair. This knowledge come to him too late. Already, all of his lairs, but one, be sterilized, as for him. And before the sunset, this shall be so. Then he will have no place where he can move and hide. I delayed this morning so we might be sure. Is there not more at stake for us than him? Then why we not be even more careful than him? By my clock, it is 1 hour, and already, if all be well, friend Arthur and Quincy are on their way to us. Today is our day, and we must go sure, if slow, and lose no chance. See? There are 5 of us when those absent ones return. Whilst he was speaking, we were startled by a knock at the hall door, the double postman's knock of the telegraph boy. We all moved out to the hall with one impulse, and Van Helsing, holding up his hand with us to keep silent, stepped on the door and opened it. The boy handed a dispatch. The professor closed the door again, and after looking in the direction, opened it and read it aloud. "Look out for D. He has just now, 12:45, come from Carfax, hurriedly, and hastened toward the south. He seems to be going the round, and may want to see you. Mina." There was a pause, broken by Jonathan Harker's voice. "Now God be thanked, we shall soon meet." Van Helsing turned to him quickly and said, "God will act in his own way in time. Do not fear, do not rejoice, as yet, for what we wish at the moment may be our undoings. I care for nothing now, he answered hotly, except to wipe out this brute from the face of creation. I would sell my soul to do it. Oh, hush, hush, my child, said Van Helsing. God does not purchase souls in this wise, and the devil, though he may purchase, does not keep faith. But God is merciful and just, and knows your pain and your devotion to that dear Madam Mina. Think how her pain would be doubled, but did she but hear your wild words. Do not fear any of us. We are all devoted to this cause, and today shall see the end. The time is coming for action. Today this vampire is limit to the powers of man, and till sunset he may not change. It will take him time to arrive here. See, it is 1:20, and there are yet some times before he can hither come, be he never so quick. What we must hope is that my lord Arthur and Quincy arrive first. About 30 minutes after we received Mrs. Harker's telegram, there came a quiet, resolute knock at the hall door. It was just an ordinary knock, such as is given hourly by thousands of gentlemen, but it made the professor's heart and mine beat loudly. We looked at each other, and together moved out into the hall. We held ready to use our various armaments, the spiritual in the left hand, the mortal in the right. Van Helsing pulled back the latch, and holding the door half open, stood back, having both hands ready for action. The gladness of our hearts must have shone upon our faces when on the step, close to the door, we saw Lord Godalming and Quincy Morris. They came quickly in and closed the door behind them, the former saying as they moved along the hall, "It's all right. We found both places, 6 boxes in each, and destroyed them all." "Destroyed?" asked the professor. "For him." We were silent for a minute, and then Quincy said, "There's nothing to do but wait here. If, however, he doesn't turn up by 5:00, we must start off, for it won't do to leave Mrs. Harker alone after sunset." "He will be here before long now," said Van Helsing, who had been consulting his pocketbook. "Nota bene, in Madame's telegram he went south from Carfax. That means he went to cross the river, and he could only do so at slack of tide, which should be something before 1:00. Then he went south. He has a meaning for us. He is, as yet, only suspicious. He went from Carfax first to the place where he would suspect interference least. You must have been at Bermondsey only a short time before him. That he is not here already shows that he went to Mile End next. This took him some time, for he would then have to be carried over the river in some way. Believe me, my friends, we should not have long to wait now. We should have ready some plan of attack, so that we may throw away no chance. Hush, there is no time now. Have all your arms. Be ready." He held up a warning hand as he spoke, for we could all hear a key softly inserted into the lock of the hall door. I could not but admire, even at such a moment, the way in which a dominant spirit asserted itself. In all our hunting parties and adventures in different parts of the world, Quincy Morris had always been the one to arrange the plan of action, and Arthur and I had been accustomed to obey him implicitly. Now, the old habits seemed to be renewed instinctively. With a swift glance around the room, he at once laid out our plan of attack, and without speaking a word, with a gesture, placed us each in position. Van Helsing, Harker, and I were just behind the door, so that when it was opened, the professor could guard it, whilst we two stepped between the incomer and the door. Godalming, behind, and Quincy in front, stood just out of sight, ready to move in front of the window. We waited in a suspense that made the seconds pass with nightmare slowness. The slow, careful steps came down the hall. The Count was evidently prepared for some surprise, or at least he feared it. Suddenly, with a single bound, he leapt into the room, winning away past us before any of us could raise a hand to stay him. There was something so panther-like in the movement, something so unhuman, that seemed to sober us all from the shock of his coming. The first to act was Harker, who, with a quick movement, threw himself before the door leaning into the room in front of the house. As the Count saw us, a horrible sort of snarl passed over his face, showing the eye teeth long and pointed. But the evil smile as quickly passed into a cold stare of lion-like disdain. His expression again changed, as with a single impulse we all advanced upon him. It was a pity that we had not some better organized plan of attack, for even at that moment I wondered what we were to do. I did not myself know whether our lethal weapon would avail us anything. Harker evidently meant to try the matter, for he had ready his great kukri knife, and made a fierce and sudden cut at him. The blow was a powerful one. Only the diabolical quickness of the Count's leap back saved him. A second less, and the trenchant blade would have shorn through his heart. As it was, the point just cut the cloth of his coat, making a wide gap whence a bundle of banknotes and a stream of gold fell out. The expression on the Count's face was so hellish that for a moment I feared for Harker, though I saw him throw the terrible knife aloft again for another stroke. Instinctively, I moved forward with a protective impulse, holding the crucifix and wafer in my left hand. I felt a mighty power along my arm, and it was without surprise that I saw the monster cower back before a similar movement made spontaneously by each of us. It would be impossible to describe the expression of hate and baffled malignity, of anger and hellish rage that came over the Count's face. His waxen hue became greenish-yellow by the contrast of his burning eyes, and the red scar on his forehead showed on the pallid skin like a palpating wound. The next instant, with a sinuous dive, he swept under Harker's arm ere his blow could fall, and grasping a handful of money from the floor, dashed across the room, threw himself at the window. Amid the crash and glitter of the falling glass, he tumbled into the flagged area below. Though the sound of the shivering glass, I could hear the ting of gold as some of the sovereigns fell on the flagging. We ran over and saw him spring unhurt from the ground. He, rushing up the steps, crossed the flagged yard and pushed open the stable door. There he turned and spoke to us. "You think to baffle me. You, with all your pale faces in a row, like sheep in a butcher's. You shall be sorry yet, each one of you. You think you have left me without a place to rest, but I have more. My revenge is just begun. I spread it over centuries, and time is on my side. Your girdles that you love are mine already, and through them you and others shall yet be mine, my creatures to do my bidding and to be my jackals when I want to feed. Bah!" With a contemptuous sneer, he passed quickly through the door, and we heard the rusty bolt creak as he fastened it behind him. A door beyond opened and shut. The first of us to speak was the professor, as, realizing the difficulty of following him through the stable, we moved towards the hall. "We've learnt something, much. Notwithstanding his brave words, he fears us. He fears time. He fears want. For if not, why he hurry so? His very tone betray him, or my ears deceive. Why take that money? You follow quick. You are hunters of wild beast, and understand it so. For me, I make sure that nothing here may be of use to him, if so he that he return." As he spoke, he put the money remaining into his pocket, took the title deeds in the bundle as Harker had left them, and swept the remaining things into the open fireplace where he set fire to them with a match. Godalming and Morris rushed out into the yard, and Harker had lowered himself from the window to follow the Count. He had, however, bolted the stable door, and by the time they forced it open there was no sign of him. Van Helsing and I tried to make inquiry at the back of the house, but the mews were deserted, and no one had seen him depart. It was now late in the afternoon, and sunset was not far off. We had to recognize that our game was up. With heavy hearts we agreed, and the professor, when he said, "Let us go back to Madame Mina." "Poor, poor, dear Madame Mina. All we can do now is done, and we can there at least protect her. But we need not despair. There is but one more earth box, and we must try to find it, for when that is done, all may yet be well." I could see that when he spoke as bravely as he did as he could to comfort Harker, the poor fellow was quite broken down. Now and again he gave a low groan which he could not suppress. He was thinking of his wife. With sad hearts we came back to my house, where we found Mrs. Harker waiting for us, with an appearance of cheerfulness that did honor to her bravery and unselfishness. When she saw our faces, her own became as pale as death. For a second or two, her eyes were closed as if she were in secret prayer, and then she said cheerfully, "I can never thank you all enough." "Oh, my poor darling!" As she spoke, she took her husband's gray head in her hands and kissed it. Lay your poor head there and rest it. All will yet be well, dear. God will protect us if he should so will it with his good intent." The poor fellow only groaned. There was no place for words in his sublime misery. We had a sort of perfunctory supper together, and I think it cheered us all up somewhat. It was perhaps the mere animal heat of food and hungry people, for none of us had eaten anything since breakfast, or the sense of companionship that may have helped us. But anyhow, we were all less miserable, and saw the morrow as not altogether without hope. True to our promise, we told Mrs. Harker everything which had passed, and although she grew snowy white at times when danger seemed to threaten her husband, and red at others when his devotion to her was manifested, she listened bravely and with calmness. When we came to the park where Harker had rushed at the Count so recklessly, she clung to her husband's arm and held it tight as though her clinging could protect him from any harm that might come. She said nothing, however, till the narration was all done, and matters had been brought up to the present time. Then, without letting go of her husband's hand, she stood amongst us and spoke. Oh, that I could give my idea of the scene, of that sweet, sweet, good, good woman in all the radiant beauty of her youth and animation, with the red scar on her forehead of which she was conscious, and which we saw the grinding of our teeth. Remembering whence and how it came, her loving kindness against our grim hate, her tender faith against all of our fears and doubting, and we, knowing that so far as symbols went, she, with all her goodness and purity and faith, was outcast from God. "Jonathan," she said, and the words sounded like music on her lips. It was so full of love and tenderness. "Jonathan, dear, and you all, my true, true friends, I want you to bear something in mind through all of this dreadful time. I know that you must fight, that you must destroy, even as you destroyed the false Lucy so that the poor, true Lucy might live hereafter. But it was not a work of hate. That poor soul, who has wrought all this misery, is the saddest case of all. Just think what will be his joy when he too is destroyed in his worser part, that his better part may have spiritual immortality. You must be pitiful to him too, though it may not hold your hands from his destruction." As she spoke, I could see her husband's face darken and draw together, as though the passion in him were shriveling his being to its core. Instinctively, the clasp on his wife's hand grew closer, till his knuckles looked white. She did not flinch from the pain which I knew she must have suffered, but looked at him with eyes that were more appealing than ever. She stopped speaking. He leapt to his feet, almost tearing his hand away from hers as he spoke. "May God give him into my hand, just for long enough to destroy that earthly life of him which we are aiming at. If beyond it I could send his soul forever and ever to burning hell, I would do it." "Oh, hush, hush, in the name of the good God, don't say such things, Jonathan, my husband, or you will crush me with fear and horror. Just think, my dear, I've been thinking all this long, long day of it, and that, perhaps, some day, I too may need such pity, and that some other like you, with equal cause for anger, may deny it to me. Oh, my husband! My husband, indeed, I would have spared you such a thought if there had been another way. But I pray that God may not have treasured your wild words, except as the heartbroken wail of a very loving and sorely stricken man. Oh God, let these poor white hairs go in evidence of what he's suffered, who all his life has done no wrong, and on whom so many sorrows has come." We men were all in tears now. There was no resisting them, and we wept openly. She wept, too, to see that her sweeter counsels had prevailed. Her husband flung himself on his knees beside her, and putting his arms around her, hid his face in the folds of her dress. Van Helsing beckoned to us, and we stole out of the room, leaving the two loving hearts alone with their God. Before they retired, the professor fixed up the room against any coming of the vampire, and assured Mrs. Harker that she might rest in peace. She tried to school herself to the belief that, and manifestly for her husband's sake, tried to seem content. It was a brave struggle, and was, I think and believe, not without its reward. Van Helsing had placed at hand a bell which either of them was to sound in case of any emergency. When they had retired, Quincy, Godalming, and I arranged that we should sit up, dividing the night between us, and watch over the safety of the poor stricken lady. The first watch falls to Quincy, so the rest of us shall be off to bed as soon as we can. Godalming has already turned in for his second watch, and now that my work is done, I shall too go to bed. Jonathan Harker's Journal. 3-4, October. Close to midnight. I thought yesterday would never end. There was over me a yearning for sleep, and some sort of blind belief that to wake would be to find things changed, and that any change must now be for the better. Before we parted, we discussed what our next step was to be, but we could arrive at no result. All we knew was that one earth box remained, and that the Count alone knew where it was. If he chooses to lie hidden, he may baffle us for years. And in the meantime... The thought is too horrible. I dare not think of it even now. This I know, that if ever there was a woman who was all perfection, that one is my poor wronged darling. I love her 1,000 times more for her sweet pity of last night, a pity that made my own hate of the monster seem despicable. Surely God will not permit the world to be poorer by the loss of a creature. This is a hope for me. We are all drifting reefwards now, and faith is our only anchor. Thank God. Mina's sleeping, and sleeping without dreams. I fear what her dreams might be like, with such terrible memories to ground them in. She's not been so calm within my seeing since the sunset. Then, for a while, there came over her face a repose which was like spring after the blasts of March. I thought at the time that it was the softness of the red sunset in her face, but somehow now I think it has a deeper meaning. I am not sleepy myself, though I am weary, weary to death. However, I must try to sleep, for there is tomorrow to think of, and there's no rest for me until... Later. I must have fallen asleep, for I was waked by Mina, who was sitting up in bed with a startled look on her face. I could see easily, for we did not leave the room in darkness. She had placed a warning hand over my mouth, and now she whispered in my ear, "Hush, there's someone in the corridor." I got up softly, and crossing the room, gently opened the door. Just outside, stretched on a mattress, lay Mr. Morris, wide awake. He raised a warning hand for silence as he whispered to me, "Hush, go back to bed. It's all right. One of us will be here all night. We don't mean to take any chances." His look and his gesture forbade discussion, so I came back and told Mina. She sighed, and positively a shadow of a smile stole over her poor, pale face as she put her arms around me and said softly, "Oh, thank God for good, brave men." With a sigh, she sank back again to sleep. I write this now as I'm not sleepy, though I must try again. 4th of October, morning. Once again, during the night, I was wakened by Mina. This time we had all had a good sleep, for the gray of the coming dawn was making the windows into sharp oblongs, and the gas flame was like a speck rather than a disk of light. She said to me hurriedly, "Go, call the professor. I want to see him at once." "Why?" I asked. "I have an idea. I suppose it must have come in the night, and matured without my knowing it. He must hypnotize me before the dawn, and then I shall be able to speak. Go quick, dearest. The time is getting close." I went to the door. Dr. Seward was resting on the mattress, and seeing me, he sprang to his feet. "Is anything wrong?" he said, in alarm. "No," I replied, "but Mina wants to see Dr. Van Helsing at once." "I will go," he said, and hurried into the professor's room. In 2 or 3 minutes later, Van Helsing was in the room with his dressing gown, and Mr. Morris and Lord Godalming were with Dr. Seward at the door asking questions. When the professor saw Mina, a smile, a positive smile, ousted the anxiety of his face. He rubbed his hands and said, "Oh, my dear Madam Mina, this is indeed a change. See, friend Jonathan, we have got our dear Madam Mina, as of old, back to us today." Then turning to her, he said cheerfully, "And what am I to do for you? For at this hour you do not want me for nothings." "I want you to hypnotize me," she said. "Do it before the dawn, for I feel that then I can speak, and speak freely. Be quick, for the time is short." Without a word, he motioned for her to sit up in bed. Looking fixatedly at her, he commenced to make passes in front of her, from the top of her head downward, with each hand in turn. Mina gazed at him fixedly for a few minutes, in which my own dear heart beat like a trip hammer, for I felt some crisis was at hand. Gradually her eyes closed, and she sat stock still. Only by the gentle heaving of her bosom could one know that she was alive. The professor made a few more passes, and then stopped, and I could see that his forehead was covered in great beads of perspiration. Mina opened her eyes, but she did not seem like she was the same woman. There was a faraway look in her eyes. Her voice had a sad dreaminess which was new to me. Raising his hand to impose silence, the professor motioned to me to bring the others in. They came on tiptoe, closing the door behind them, and stood at the front of the bed looking on. Mina appeared not to see them. The stillness was broken by Van Helsing's voice, speaking in a low-level tone which would not break the current of her thoughts. "Where are you?" The answer came in a neutral way.
"I do not know. Sleep has no place it can call its own."
For several minutes there was silence. Mina sat rigid, and the professor stood staring at her fixedly. The rest of us hardly dared to breathe. The room was growing lighter. Without taking his eyes from Mina's face, Dr. Van Helsing motioned me to pull up the blind. I did so, and the day seemed just upon us. A red streak shot up, and a rosy light seemed to diffuse itself through the room. On the instant, the professor spoke again.
"Where are you now?"
The answer came dreamily, but with intention. It were as though she were interpreting something. I've heard her use the same tone when reading her shorthand notes.
"I do not know. It is all strange to me."
"What do you see?"
"I can see nothing. It is all dark."
"What do you hear?"
I could detect the strain in the professor's patient voice.
"The lapping of water. It is gurgling by, and little waves leap. I can hear them on the outside."
"Then you're on a ship?" We all looked at each other, trying to glean something each from the other. We were all afraid to think. The answer came quick.
"Oh, yes."
"What else do you hear?"
"The sound of men stamping overhead as they run about. There's the creaking of a chain, and the loud tinkle as the check of a capstan falls into the ratchet."
"What are you doing?"
"I am still.
Oh, so still.
It is like death."
The voice faded into a deep breath as if one sleeping, and the open eyes closed again. By this time the sun had risen, and we were all in the full light of day. Dr. Van Helsing placed his hands on Mina's shoulders and laid her head down softly on the pillow. She lay like a sleeping child for a few moments, and then, with a long sigh, awoke and stared at wonder to see us all around her. "Have I been talking in my sleep?" was all she said. She seemed, however, to know the situation without telling, though she was eager to know what she had told. The professor repeated the conversation, and she said, "Well, then there is not a moment to lose. It may not be too late." Mr. Morris and Lord Godalming started for the door, but the professor's calm voice called them back. "Stay, my friends. That ship, wherever it was weighing anchor whilst she spoke. There are many ships weighing anchor at the moment in your so great port of London. Which one of them is it that you seek? God be thanked that we once again have a clue, though whither it may lead us we know not. We have been blind somewhat, blind after the manner of men, since we can look back to see what we might have seen looking forward if we had been able to see what we might have seen. Alas, but that sentence is a puzzle, is it not? We can know now what was in the Count's mind when he seized that money, though Jonathan's so fierce knife put him in the danger that he dread. He meant escape. Hear me, escape. He saw that with but one earth box left, and a pack of men following like dogs after a fox, this London was no place for him. He must take his last earth box on board a ship, and he leave the land. He think to escape, but no, we follow him. Tally-ho, as friend Arthur would say when he put on his red frock. Our old fox is wily, so wily, and we must follow with wile. I, too, am wily, and I think his mind in a little while. In meantime, we may rest and in peace, for there are waters between us which he do not want to pass, and which he could not if he would, unless the ship were to touch the land, and only then at full or slack tide.
See, and the sun is just rose, and all day is sunset to us. Let us take bath, and dress, and have breakfast, which we all need, and which we can eat comfortable since he be not in the same land as us." Mina looked at him appealingly as she asked, "But why need we seek him further when he's gone away from us?" He took her hand and patted it as he replied, "Ask me nothings as of yet. When we have breakfast, then I answer all questions." He would say no more, and we separated to dress. After breakfast, Mina repeated her question. He looked at her gravely for a minute, and then said sorrowfully, "Because, my dear, dear Madam Mina, now more than ever must we find him, even if we have to follow him to the jaws of hell." She grew paler, as she asked faintly, "Why?" "Because," he answered solemnly, "he can live for centuries, and you are but mortal woman. Time is now to be dreaded, since once he put that mark upon your throat." I was just in time to catch her, as she fell forward into a faint. Dr. Seward's phonograph diary, spoken by Van Helsing. "This to Jonathan Harker. You are to stay with your dear Madam Mina. We shall go to make our search, if I can call it so, for it is not search, but knowing, and we seek confirmation only. But do you stay and take care of her today. This is your best and most holiest office. This day nothing can find him here. Let me tell you, so that you will know what we four know already, for I have told them. He, our enemy, have gone away. He have gone back to his castle in Transylvania. I know it so well, as if a great hand of fire wrote it on the wall. He have prepared for this in some way, and that last earth box was ready to ship somewheres. For this he took the money. For this he hurry at the last, lest we catch him before the sun go down. It was his last hope, save that he might hide in the tomb that he think poor Lucy, and he, as he thought like him, keep open for him. But there was not of time. When that fail, he make straight for his last resource, his last earthwork. I did say he might, I wish double entendre. He is so clever. Oh, so clever. He knew that his game here was finished, and so he decide he go back home. He find ship going by that route he came, and he go in it. We go off now to find that ship, and whither bound. When we discover that, we come back and tell you all. Then we will comfort you, and poor dear Madam Mina with new hope. For it will be hope when you think it over, that all is not lost. This very creature that we pursue, he take hundreds of years to get so far as London. And yet, in one day, when we know the disposal of him, we drive him out. He is finite, though he is powerful to do much harm, and suffers not as we do. But we are strong, each to our purpose, and we are all more strong together. Take heart afresh, dear husband of Madam Mina. This battle is but begun, and in the end we shall win, so sure that God sits on high to watch over his children. Therefore, be much of comfort till we return. Van Helsing." Jonathan Harker's Journal, 4th of October. When I read to Mina Van Helsing's message in the phonograph, the poor girl brightened up considerably. Already the certainty of the Count being out of the country has given her comfort, and comfort is strength to her. For my own part, now that this horrible danger is not face to face with us, it seems almost impossible to believe in it. Even my own terrible experiences in Castle Dracula seem like a long-forgotten dream. Here, in the crisp autumn air and the bright sunlight? Alas, how can I disbelieve? In the midst of my thought, my eye fell on the red scar on my poor darling's white forehead. Whilst that lasts, there can be no disbelief, and afterwards the very memory of it will keep faith crystal clear. Mina and I fear to be idle, so we've been all over the diaries, again and again. Somehow, although the reality seems greater each time, the pain and fear seem less. There's something of a guiding purpose manifest throughout, which is comforting. Mina says, perhaps we're the instruments of ultimate good. It may be. I shall try to think as she does. We've never spoken to each other yet of the future. It is better to wait till we see the professor and the others after their investigations. The day is running by more quickly than I ever thought a day could run for me again. It's now 3 o'clock. Mina Harker's Journal, 5th of October, 5 p.m. Our meeting for report. Present, Professor Van Helsing, Lord Godalming, Dr. Seward, Mr. Quincy Morris, Jonathan Harker, Mina Harker. Dr. Van Helsing described what steps were taken during the day to discover on what boat and whither bound Count Dracula made his escape. As I knew that he wanted to get back to Transylvania, I felt sure he must go by the Danube mouth, or by somewhere in the Black Sea, since by that way he come. It was a dreary blank that was before us, omne ignotum pro magnifico. And so, with heavy hearts, we start to find what ships leave for the Black Sea at night. He was in sailing ship, since Madam Mina tale of sails being set. These not so important as to go in your list at the shopping of the times, and as we go, by suggestion of your Lord Godalming to your Lloyds, wear our note of all ships that sail, however so small. There we find that only one Black Sea-bound ship go out with the tide. She is the Tsarina Catherine, and she sail from Doolittle's wharf for Varna, and thence on to other ports and up the Danube. So, said I, this is ship where is the Count. We go off to Doolittle's wharf. We there find a man in an office of wood so small the man looked bigger than the office. From him we inquire of the goings of the Tsarina Catherine. He swear much, and he red face and loud of voice, but he good fellow all the same. And when Quincy give him something from his pocket, which crackled as he roll it up, and put it in so small bag which he have hid deep in his clothing, he still is better and humble servant to us. He come with us, and ask many men who are rough and hot. These be better fellows too, when they have been no more thirsty. They say much of blood and bloom, and of others which I comprehend not, though I can guess what they mean. Nevertheless, they tell us all the things we want to know. They make known to us among them how last afternoon, about 5 o'clock, comes a man, so hurry, a tall man, thin and pale, with high nose and teeth so white, and eyes that seem to be burning, that he be in all black, except that he have a half straw which not suit him at the time, that he scatter his money in making quick inquiry as to what ship sails for the Black Sea and for where. Some took him to the office and then to the ship, where he will not go aboard, but halt at shore end of gangplank, and ask that captain come to him. The captain come, when told he will pay well, and though he swear much at the first, he agree to term. Then the thin man go, and someone tell him where horse and cart can be hired. He go there, and soon he come again, driving himself cart on which is great box. This he himself lift down, though it takes several to put it on the truck for the ship. He give much talk to the captain as to how and where his box is to be placed, but the captain like it not, and swear at him in many tongues, and tell him that if he like, he can come and see where it shall be. But he say no, that he have not come yet, for he have much to do. Whereupon the captain tell him he better be quick, with blood, for that his ship will leave the place of blood before the turn of the tide, with blood. Then the thin man smile and say that of course he must go when he think fit, but he will be surprised if he go quite so soon. The captain swear again, polyglot, and the thin man make him bow, and thank him, and say that he will so far intrude on his kindness as to come aboard before the sailing. Final the captain, more red than ever, and in more tongues, tell him he doesn't want no Frenchmen, with bloom upon them, and also with blood, in his ship, with blood on her also. And so, after asking where there might be at close at hand a shop he might purchase ship forms, he departed. No one knew where he went, or bloomin' well cared, as they said, for they had something else to think of. Well, with blood again, it soon became apparent to all that the Tsarina Catherine would not sail as was expected. A thin mist began to creep up from the river, and it grew and grew till soon a dense fog enveloped the ship and all around her. The captain swore, polyglot, very polyglot, polyglot with bloom and blood, but he could do nothing. The water rose and rose, and he began to fear that he would lose the tide altogether. He was in no friendly mood, when just at full tide, the thin man came up the gangplank again, and asked to see where his box had been stowed. The captain then replied that he wished that he and his box, old and with much bloom and blood, were in hell. But the thin man did not offend, and went down with the mate to saw where it was placed, and came up and stood a while in the deck with fog. He must have come off by himself, for no one noticed him. Indeed, they thought not of him, for soon the fog began to melt away, and all was clear again. This has been Rachel Reading Bookshelf, with part 13 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Have a wonderful day.